Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sparum Chatter podcast. So in this episode of the podcast, we'll be joined again, a second time, by Professor Lawrence Schiffman, who's the Judge Abraham Lieberman Professorship in Hebrew and Judaic Studies at NYU, New York University. And we'll be discussing Hanukkah. Obviously, we're recording this before Hanukkah, but in Mitzvah Shem, this will be released on Hanukkah. So first of all, thank you, Professor Schiffman, for joining me again.
You are welcome.
Good evening. I think we should start Gemara says, my Hanukkah, let's start right over there.
Okay, so I think that there's a simple way of answering this, which is usually what people say, which is simply that Antiochus came and he started persecuting the Jews and they rebelled and they won, and then they rededicated the temple and lit the menorah. But this is way too simple a version. What really happened is that beginning in 198 BCE, the Seleucid Empire, which was the part of Alexander the Great's old empire that was being ruled from Syria, gained control of Eretz Israel. And this began a process of increased influence of Hellenistic culture, of this kind of amalgam of Greek culture with various native Near Eastern cultures. And as this situation continued, some Jews sought to gain control of the society in general in the base of Mikdash, who wanted in varying degrees to accommodate to this Hellenistic culture. Now, what happened beginning in 175 is that one of them bought the Kahuna Gadola, the high priesthood, from Antiochus. And as a result of this, there began to be some serious strife, but it didn't really heat up until a second one, whose name was Menelaus, bought out the kahuna. And in his case, what happened is that he sought to greatly increase this process of Hellenization. There were two reasons for this. One of them, which is very, very important, was the economic reason to be part of the Greco-Roman world. But the other one was that these people were similar to, you might say, assimilationists in many ways. At any rate, this began a kind of building up of strife. And then Antiochus himself was in a kind of fiasco campaign trying to conquer Egypt from the Romans. And on his way back from that campaign, he came and he plundered the base of Mikdash. And these particular Hellenistic types were in support of him. Well, as he left, there began to break out what we would call the revolt. But it broke out first as the kind of low-level street violence between the parties. And then when an idol was actually introduced into the base of Mikdash, it then led to an increase of this kind of street violence, etc. And Antiochus decided that the way he could solve the problem would be to come in on the side of the Hellenists, and the way to uproot the anti-Hellenists was to persecute Judaism. And that's the point when they outlawed circumcision, and Shabbos observance, and try to get people to observe idols. And according to one Maccabees, that's the point when Matityahu began the revolt by killing the Jew in Modi'in who was ready to actually do this. And then he, followed by his five sons, and as he soon died, and his son Yehuda, and then some of the other brothers carried on, they fought these battles, continued to fight the battles. A very long story with all kinds of details that we know from the books of the Maccabees, until such time as they were victorious initially. I say initially because the Hanukkah story does not end with the rededication. The rededication and lighting of the menorah were very important, but it's necessary to understand that soon after that, an idea was proposed by some Jews that there be a settlement in which Antiochus would recognize the rights of Jews, a kind of amnesty, to practice their religion, and in return, a Kohen Gadol that he wanted, Alkimus, who's known as Yakim in the Gemara, would serve. And essentially, the Chashmonaim were thrown out, and the Beis Hamikdash was now in the hands of moderate Hellenizers with their own Kohen Gadol. In 100, remember that 164 was the rededication of the temple and the lighting of the menorah. But in 160, Yehuda was still fighting battles, and he fell on the battlefield. And after he fell on the battlefield, the struggle was taken up first by Shimon, who then himself was killed, and then by Yonatan. And Yonatan was successful because by that time, Antiochus had died, and there were two pretenders fighting for who would rule over Syria in the Seleucid Empire, and he promised his troops, which by that time, according to our sources, he had 10,000 men in the field, but not in Jerusalem, because they had been kicked out. And he promised his support to one of those two candidates, the weaker one, very wisely. And as a result, he was given the right to rule and become Kohen Gadol in Jerusalem. And that's the beginning of the kingdom of the Hashmonaim, which then continues until 63 BCE when the Romans conquered Eretz Yisrael. So the story, the beautiful ending of the story, is not the end of the story. And sadly, Yehuda did not live long enough to benefit and to live to celebrate his own victory.
Right. And I think that's an important point that you make, people may not be aware of. So I think as brief as possible, maybe you touched on it, but maybe just start off the story of Hanukkah until they lit the menorah, until the story of Hanukkah from the beginning of the revolt. Maybe just mention that briefly, and we'll get to the sources in a minute. Just to the, you know, from when Matisyo, when the story of Modi, and what was that story, and what was it like?
Well, this is a famous, this very famous story sold in 1 Maccabees, and created a song that some people sing, where it says he struck the traitor to the earth or something like that. It's one of these old fashioned Jewish kid songs from the 1950s. At any rate, the story there was that what happened was that the Hellenistic forces of Antiochus came to the village of Modiin, and they knew since he was a leader, he was a Kohen, and his sons, they were all very important there. They assembled everybody, and they tried to get him to worship an idol. And he, of course, would not worship the idol. And then they tried to get his sons to worship the idol. They wouldn't worship the idol. And when they wouldn't worship the idol, they started offering all kinds of things because the commander didn't want to kill anyone. So he says, look, if somebody will worship this idol, I can go home and I can say I didn't do anything and I didn't have to kill anybody. And if you don't, you know, I'm going to have to take action. So some Jew figured he'll come forward. So he came forward and he was going to do this Avodah Zarah, and Matityahu stepped up and stabbed him and made the initial call, which led Jews to flee to the woods and to start arming themselves and create the initial army. The point is to realize, though, that this didn't happen just out of nowhere, because the tremendous unrest was breeding among the Jews constantly in the lead-up period to this, because of this inner struggle that had been going on among Jews as to the extent to which to Hellenize and how to draw the lines between somehow or another accommodating to the general society and really, we could jokingly use the expression, going whole hog, because that's what we were talking about over here, right? And the truth is that it was that struggle which already created this tension that brought Matityahu to this effort and the decision that something had to be done about it. And by the way, the books of the 1 Maccabees describes him like Pinchas, because he came forward with the sword. It's basically the symbolist type of situation as Pinchas.
Was he Alanisim? We read in Alanisim Matzio Kohen Gadol. Was he actually Kohen Gadol? That just means like a great leader, a great Kohen.
Yeah, no, I think it probably means that he was a great leader, because one of the solutions to that problem would theoretically be to say that Yochanan, Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, but the Yochanan Kohen Gadol is the one who's called in English John Hyrcanus, and he was the Kohen Gadol from 134 to 104 BCE. So it won't work to say that that's the Yochanan. There was no earlier Yochanan, and we actually know all the names. I couldn't recite them, but we know the names of all the Kohen Gadolim that existed at that time.
Right, so it's more like a figure of speech. So we've alluded to Maccabees 1. So I think listeners may not be fully familiar. Why don't you mention briefly the overall literature that we have about the Hanukkah story, everything that touches on it, and talk briefly about them before we go more in depth.
Okay, by the way, I'll make a brief advertisement, which is that in the Hanukkah issue of Ami magazine, I'm writing about this topic, so I'll be able to read a little bit about it there. So the sources are as follows. The earliest source that we have about Hanukkah is what we call 1 Maccabees, which in Hebrew is also often called Hashmonaim Aleph. It's not called Maccabees 1. Now, let me just talk about these terms. The only one who really was named Maccabee is Yehuda. However, the Christians who passed down these texts took Maccabees, as we very often do when we speak about the Maccabees revolting, the Maccabean revolt, they took Maccabees as if it was a name for the whole family. Now, we know that Matityahu was a descendant of someone named Hashmonai, which gives us that name, Hashmonaim. Now, back to the actual question here. So these books of Maccabees, the one we call 1 Maccabees, you have to understand, 1 and 2 Maccabees, not like Shmuel Al or Shmuel Bet. They're totally different books. Now, 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees both were preserved for us in the Greek Bibles, generally known as the Septuagint, which became, they were translated into Latin, became the Latin Bibles, the Vulgate, which was kept by the Catholic Church, so that every one of your Catholic neighbors has 1 and 2 Maccabees in his or her Bible, which is kind of funny. I always think it's kind of a joke. But at any rate, they've got 1 and 2 Maccabees. Now, 1 Maccabees was probably written in Hebrew, although we only have it in Greek, probably written in Hebrew, something like 100 BCE. But it's not all that clear because it stops actually between the rededication and Yehuda's death. And it stops by describing the battle with the commander Nicanor. Now, Nicanor was the one who, according to Megillat Ta'anit, which Halacha sets aside, it's not observed anymore, but it was a list of days on which it was forbidden. Shulchan Aruch says we don't do it anymore, forbidden to do funerals, hesped, and fasting. At any rate, not to do funerals, but to give a hesped, a funeral, right? And there, they describe the day of Nicanor is the day that for us is Tanit Esther. So, but on that, it's around that time, on that day, so what happened was Nicanor was defeated, and that's where 1 Maccabees ends. 1 Maccabees basically, not totally, basically makes it out as if Antiochus came one day and decided I'm going to persecute the Jews and make them act like Hellenistic people, even though it does say in a few psukim that there were Jews who wanted this to happen. Now, that work only survives for us in Greek and in translations from Greek. The Hebrew editions that are available are only modern. They were done in the modern period. Now, then you have the Book of 2 Maccabees, which first of all tells the whole story of the Hellenistic infighting of the Jews in the lead up to the revolt, which causes Antiochus to come in and persecute the Jews. And 2 Maccabees is itself a summary. Fancy word for that is an epitome. Scholars call it an epitome. It's a summary of a 5-volume work by a guy named Jason of Cyrene. Cyrene is in today's Tunisia, in North Africa, who wrote a 5-volume work in Greek about this whole thing. This work goes into some of the Hasmonean rulers afterwards, and it's generally also believed to have been written somewhere around 100 BCE, although no one's sure for either one of these books. But our Book of Maccabees is a summary, 2 Maccabees, it's a summary of this work. Now, it has 2 big differences, 1 I mentioned already, which is that it tells the story of the lead up and the inner Hellenistic fighting, which is not told about in 1 Maccabees. But the second thing that it does that's not in the 1 Maccabees, or that differs from 1 Maccabees, is that there are discrepancies which are minor about the order of the battles and how they took place, and different things that scholars try to reconstruct the exact order. Everybody has his own opinion, but the reality of the situation is there's no way to know exactly the order of some of these battles. And there are, as they say, some small differences. They don't really matter because the overall course of the revolt remains the same. And one of the things that people should realize is that the Jewish side had very large armies. The Hashmonaim had very large armies. And now, then you have to know that the next story of what information we have is the information that we have in Josephus. Josephus simply repeats 1 Maccabees with a few additions, and then, of course, tells the whole rest of the story all the way through the conquest by the Romans in 63 BC and all the way through the revolt in 66 to 73 and destruction of the temple and Masada and all that. However, Josephus, for the period of the Maccabees, doesn't know 2 Maccabees, simply copies 1 Maccabees, makes a few small changes. Now, this is the point when the rabbinic sources come, going historical order. The earliest rabbinic sources are not the version in the Gemara and Shabbos. The earliest version is in what we call the Scholion, which is like a Gemara, the Megillas Tanis. Megillat Tanit is a calendar which lists these days on which is forbidden to fast and forbidden to mourn. And it lists all kind of minor holidays of the Jews, and in there is Hanukkah. Now, here, if you open up a version of the text that you buy, a normal one, it will tell the story of the lighting of the menorah and the Hachashemen and the oil burning for 8 days. However, we have this phenomenal edition by Vered Noam, who just won the Israel Prize in Talmud. And in this edition, she discovered that there are two versions of the original text. And then on top of those versions of the original text, there is what she calls the Nusach HaKilayim, the shatnez of the two versions. Now, the Nusach HaKilayim itself has later editions. In the early versions, and you can see this by a comparison with a copy in the Or Zeruah of this, the main menorah story is not this one. It's the one that's told three times in the Gemara, and I opened the book so I get the references properly, in Rosh Hashanah Kaf Dalet Amud Bet, Avodah Zarah Mem Gimel Amud Aleph, Menachot Kaf Chet Amud Bet, of coming in there and finding there's no menorah, or it's been made impure, and sticking seven lances into the floor and putting the lights on top of these spears. Now, this story is three times in the Gemara. Now, if you look in later commentaries, like some of the popular type commentaries that are used today, you will find out that they say that this is basically the same story by somehow harmonized, but it's not. It's a competing story of what happened when they found not that there was no oil, but that there was no menorah. Now, then you get to the Gemara, and it is quoted from the Tanaim. So sometime, who knows, first, second century, right? You have the quotation of the famous Maaseh Hanukkah, when the Gemara looks like it's quoting from Megillat Tanit, but it's quoting a different version according to which the oil was insufficient and burned for 8 days. The next source in historical order that we have is the Al Hanisim, probably written in the time of the Amoraim, or perhaps early Gaonic, but it's in the Seder of Amram Gaon, so it's clearly before then. And there we know the story. We all note that it doesn't tell the story of the oil, but nonetheless, it emphasizes the military victory and tells that story. And then the next source that we have after that is a source which is known as Megillat Antiochus. It used to be read by some Jews. It's kind of sounds like Megillah Esther. Now, I'm in a minority here. I believe it was composed in Hebrew and the Aramaic is a translation. And the reason I believe that is because the imitation of Esther. Since it's an imitation of lingo, the language of Esther, but that's what I think. But the majority view, like Encyclopedia Judaica, all these places, that it was composed in Aramaic. We have it from the Middle Ages in Aramaic and Hebrew. Rav Sadia Gaon had it. And this is very important because of the following reason. We will not learn the names of the Chashmonaim from any Hebrew source that we have until we get to the time of the Gaonim. That is to say that although numerous Jews, tremendous numbers, had the names of Yehuda and Shimon and Yonatan, right? All the names of the Maccabean brothers, Yochanan, right? They had these names, right? Elazar, they all had these names. And there were famous names, like people were naming their kids after these people. Nonetheless, the Gemara does not mention their names. And we only know those names from later sources. And it starts with Megillat Antiochus. And then Rav Sadia Gaon quotes this. And it's certainly a known text. Now, the important turning point for real infusion of the traditions of 1 and 2 Maccabees into the Jewish consciousness comes with Yosifon. Yosifon is an author that in 900 and something, the exact date actually is close to known, 953 probably, he got a hold of he was living in the south of Italy, where they say that most people spoke Greek there, but at any rate, he got a hold of a Latin translation of Josephus and created Sefer Yosifon. Sefer Yosifon is mostly based on Josephus, but he didn't use the whole Josephus, or maybe didn't have the whole Josephus, and also he had additional sources. he translates Josephus and other sources into Hebrew. And among those sources, he doesn't just use one Maccabees. He has two Maccabees. So he creates the first synthesis of the whole story from one and two Maccabees. And as many people know, Rashi and various Rishonim, Balei HaTosfos, made use of his work. And from that, those few Jews that bothered to read Jewish historical works like this learned about this, all this information. Now, he was labeled as Yosef Ben Gurion, his author. It's not clear that was whether that was his real name or not, but a lot of people thought that must be the name of Josephus, but Josephus' father was Matityahu. He tells us that in the work called The Life, and he, by the way, Josephus was a descendant of the Maccabean family. But nonetheless, the Yosiphone came into the Jewish consciousness, and that's where Jews first found out about it. And Jews did not start reading Josephus in its own, in Greek or Latin, until the Renaissance, because in the Renaissance, they rediscovered that the Christians were holding all this literature. The Christians had passed down Josephus. The Christians had passed down the two books of Maccabees, and the Jews only got these books really from Yosiphone. Right. That's a basic summary of the sources.
Right. And is it, so it's safe to say that a lot of the story as it's known today in the firm world would be from Yosefon, right? Through the Rishonim.
That is correct. I neglected to mention one other source, which is there are a variety of medieval midrashim that are often called Masei Chanukah that have to do with what's called in fancy Latin, right? Jus prima noctis, which means the rite of the first night. And this is the account of how it was required that brides have relations with the so-called hegemon, the general, before their weddings. And that Jewish women, of course, obviously sacrificed or martyred themselves. And this was one of the reasons why so many Jews joined the revolt. And I'll mention also, right, that besides this, there are various midrashim. The Rambam has a very interesting account, but when you read the Rambam's account, if you examine it closely, if you go to some of the editions that do well with giving you the sources, you can see that every single detail that the Rambam mentions comes from a Midrashic source. So it's clear that he did not have the books in the Maccabees. And anyhow, they circulated in Christian Europe. They didn't circulate in the Muslim countries.
Right. Okay, so I think we should now maybe delve a little bit more into the sources that you mentioned. So Maccabeim, like I said, Maccabees, Chashmonaim, Maccabees 1 and 2. So to start with 1, was it originally written in Greek or in Hebrew? We obviously have, like you said,
we think it was originally written in Hebrew, but we have no copy of it in Hebrew. And sadly, I think the Dead Sea Scrolls sectarians didn't like the Hasmonean rulers. They didn't put the book in, so we don't have the book. Bottom line, we only have this work in Greek.
And do we know who the author was, and do we know about the author?
No, we know that the author was a big fan of the Hashmonaim. He loved them. That we know. He could have been even an official historian, but we just don't know anything else. And the big question is, why did he stop where he stopped? Unless he really, for him, that was the whole story. Once Nicanor was killed, it was the final victory. But he doesn't run through even Yonatan's taking control. You only learn about that in 2 Maccabees. So it's hard to understand what he understood as his work.
Right. And would he be, I mean, I've saw it written this way, would he be considered a frum person, like a prushim at that time?
But let me tell you, when you read the books, they are loaded with, first of all, tefillah and beautiful prayers that people say. They are loaded with concern for what I would say is what there's a scholar named E.P. Sanders. He came up with a very good term, common Judaism. Common Judaism means no matter what you are, if you lived in those days and you were a loyal Jew, you had Shabbos, you had Kashrut, you had Mila, you had these things. Everybody did it, these festivals, right? And all Jews would be against things like reversing circumcision and people going to do athletic games with no clothes on. This is typical Judaism. So the bottom line is that the author of both of these works, the authors, both stood for this kind of Judaism. You're not going to be able to decide what of the groups, Puchim, Sukim, etc., you're not going to be able to decide because none of that comes through anywhere, because it's like this. They're, it's time to take off for Shabbat. It's Shabbos, we have to stop marching. Okay, every Jew would stop marching on Shabbos. But that's the point, is that every sect would, because they're all trying to observe the Torah. So you can't really get to that level. Now, there was also, we have to remember, both books of Maccabees describe the group called the Hasidim, who may or may not be the Hasidim HaRishonim of Shas. And this group is the group that refused to fight on Shabbos. And it was the Hashmonaim who said that you're supposed to fight on Shabbos if you need to save your life. But these Hasidim gave up their lives. Then later on, they reappear because they support the compromise with Alkimus. And this is because they are concerned with religious freedom, but not political freedom. And we have to understand that the ideology of the Hashmonaim and their followers was that it's almost like it's halachically asur to be ruled by non-Jews. And therefore, they fought for that. And this is one of the reasons eventually of the revolt against Rome, that same concept. Jews should never be under someone else's domination. And there's no question that both books of the Maccabees buy into that. But you can't try to get into exactly what group they believe. You know, were they Belzers or Satmers or Yeshivish, Litvish? You know, it's not going to work.
Right. I do want to point out also that I will get to this later, but there's a new from a Hebrew edition of Maccabeum Aleph. I do want to mention, he touches on in here, just for people that listening might be curious, that it's one of the Svarim Chitzonim Apocrypha. So the Gemara says, or Kiva says, in the Chilik Mahaba. So he says that he brings this down. He goes through this, that the Brisa says that Rabbi Kiva is talking about Sefer Minim. He says, look in the Yad Ramah, you look in the Shuvah Zerivash, you look in other Mefarshim. It's not referring to this, and you are allowed to use it. And brings
another thing, which the Shulchan Aruch does not decide, according to Rabbi Kiva. It's not written in the Shulchan Aruch that you can't read Sfarim Chitzonim. The Shulchan Aruch objects to reading certain books on Shabbos, but it doesn't say anyway you can't read. That's not the same. See, the question is, these are not books. There's no heresy in these books.
Right, no, I just wanted to point it out for people. Also, he makes a list, and I'll just mention, I'm sure you know this, but he says that David Gans in the Tzemach David quotes Maccabeum, and he says the Tosis Yom Tov quotes it, and he brings down, he has a whole list of Yerbi Yaakov Emden mentions it, the El Yoraba mentions it. So there were Gedolim that had some sort of translation, some addition to Maccabeum.
100%, yeah. And I think the interesting question is, though, you see, there are other issues, because we could get from that into, we have now the whole book of Ben-Sira. And the Gemara quotes, the Gemara and the Midrash together, they quote Ben-Sira 11 times. But we have the whole book of Ben-Sira. And actually, it's very worth reading the book of Ben-Sira. You learn a lot of interesting things about what people were thinking in those days and what the concerns were of Jews at the time. But Ben-Sira somehow hasn't come back. And the Maccabees, the truth is that very few religious Jews have read Maccabees. And this is kind of crazy, because you think everybody would want to know what happened at the time. And they've all these great stories, and kids love it, you know? It's just not become popular.
Right, so that's what I wanted to mention. So I'll just mention now already, there was a new edition published about 2 years ago in Eretz Yisrael. It's called Maccabeum Aleph. It was actually published by Tzuf, which is a very yeshivish publisher, and someone, Levi Yitzchak Haritin, he published a critical edition with pictures in a Hebrew translation, a critical frum edition, which many people, he brings, you know, he mazb all the psukim according to Chazal, and he goes through all the Makairis, and so it's just very interesting. If anyone could get a hold of a copy, it's like you said, it's fascinating to read the story to see what exactly happened to the Maccabeum. So
you see, the real missing ingredient here is that so many religious Jews don't care about Jewish history. And it's very strange. It really is strange. And you have many people who know much more about, say, American history, because they had to take it in school and social studies, than they know about the history of the Jews. And we have very many schools where if you ask them, why don't you teach Jewish history, we don't have time. And so, you know, this is a whole other question which needs to be asked about. There's so many lessons of history to be learned, not because it repeats itself, it doesn't repeat itself, but there's a lot to be learned, because many things do end up having similar challenges and similar circumstances. And for some reason, it doesn't seem to be that most people are interested in it. So that's, otherwise you'd think that everybody would be reading the books of the Maccabees before Hanukkah.
Right, it's definitely fascinating. Yeah. I just recently went through a lot of it. Something we didn't touch on, though, is that both of them, like you said, Yehuda was called Yehuda Maccabee, not the rest of the family. But either way, somehow became known as the Maccabeum. Is that, right. You know, can you touch on, is that supposed to be spelled Maccabeum with a kuf? Or
We don't know how to spell this word. So there are two theories about why he's called, you know, Maccabee.
Right.
One theory is that he's called Maccabee because it's for Makeve, a hammer. Now, then you have a problem. Why should he be named for a hammer? So one is that he was like a hammer in battle because he could beat anyone. The other is, and this is really maybe humorous, that he had a, quote, hammer head, close quotes, which means a very flat head. Well, okay, this is all, you know, fun to talk about. We don't know. The other one that you usually see in Jewish books is that it's an abbreviation of a Michamocha Be'lim Hashem, right? But the truth is that in Hebrew today, it's written with a kuf, not with a kaf. But you do see the Michamocha Be'lim Hashem, right? And that is generally very common. It's told to children. Again, it's a nice lesson, but we don't really know if that's true.
Right, I'm trying to find it as we speak. In this edition, he goes through it. He actually spells with a kuf. He says it should be with a kuf. I think the Rekech is the one, Blazer Gormazi is the one who says that it's Mikamech Ben Hashem. But interestingly, he talks about the hammerhead. He mentions here that the issue would be the Mishnah, I think, or the Gemara says that you would be, it's a psul kohuna. You wouldn't be able to serve if you have the hammerhead. So he said there's some source that says Yehuda maybe served as Kohen Gadol and said that wouldn't be able to be the case if he was a hammerhead. Because
anyhow, historically, I don't think he served as Kohen Gadol.
Right, no. Whatever. But I guess even I think even in general, in the basic right. It should be a problem. So...
But anyhow, listen, I think this expression of like a hammerhead is not a deformity. It's just that his face is flatter than the average person. So I don't think that's really a move.
Right. Oh, no, because he brings that. He says that Josephus says that he served in... Josephus is the one who says he served as a Kohen Gadol, he says. As he brings. So he said if that's the case, it wouldn't work. I don't know. It's over here on page 24. If anyone has this edition, footnote 6, he goes through the whole thing. So the other thing... would be is that we didn't discuss really Maccabees. I mean, you mentioned Maccabees 2. So what do we know of the author of Maccabees 2? And was that originally written in Hebrew or in Greek?
The problem is like this. Maccabees 2 is Greek. Okay. As far as we know, there was never anything written in Hebrew. The author of 2 Maccabees, Jason of Cyrene, lived sometime in the first century BCE, approximately circa 100 BCE or so, because that's when the book ends. And he lived in North Africa, Cyrene, otherwise known as Cyrenaica, was a rather large center with a big Jewish community. You know, at that time, there were Jews all over North Africa by that time. And there was a Jewish community there. And somehow or another, he had access to this information. Now, maybe he didn't live in Cyrenaica. He may have come from Cyrenaica and written the book. He may have lived in Eretz Yisrael and lived in the book of Israel. What do we know? But at any rate, that's most logical. How else would he know the whole story and all the details? But he wrote a 5-volume work. That work does not survive. What survives is a summary of that work to which the author of, whatever you want to call him, the summarizer of 2 Maccabees, put on a little bit different introduction and conclusion. But the work as a whole is basically Jason of Cyrenaica's account summarized. Again, it's also pro-Maccabean, but the big deal is that the whole lesson that people talk about today all over the place about the question of Hellenism and assimilation and how Hanukkah was brought on by Jews assimilating, and this whole lesson comes from this book. You wouldn't have known it without 2 Maccabees. And what's really interesting is to see that in modern times, despite the history that you quoted of people reading the books of the Maccabees, the reality is that the biggest influence of Maccabees happened in the Jewish community in modern times. In modern times, a whole bunch of themes came to the fore. One of those themes was nationalism. Another one of those themes is fighting against religious persecution, which of course is freedom of religion, which isn't exactly accurate because the Maccabees fought against pagans and Jews who observed paganism. So they didn't believe freedom of religion, they believed freedom of religion of Judaism, right? But at any rate, and then another theme that keeps that's very important that comes in modern times is this business of assimilation and Hellenization and all these things. And also another really interesting you see in modern times, probably the influence of the role of Zionism in the understanding of Hanukkah, starting already in the 1800s, is the notion of taking up, even though it's Al-Hanisim, the military side of it, and saying that there are two separate miracles, or not separate, two interrelated miracles: the miracle of the military victory, and the military, and the one of the candles burning, you know, of the lamp burning. We shouldn't use the word candle, not candles, it's lamps, right? But at any rate, the two themes coming together, and you see it over and over in modern times in the most traditional sources, as well as this assimilation theme that you hear about constantly, is coming out of the works of the Books of Maccabees, coming into Jewish culture and Jewish civilization, mostly in the modern era.
Right. So interestingly, you're saying they're both, you know, they're different and they're interesting. So if somebody was going to pick one to read, would it be Maccabees 1 that they should read?
I won't know if I would say that. I'd say everyone should read both.
But if they had to pick one, this year, what would you say?
Well, I'm not sure. I think I might say 2 Maccabees, and I'll tell you why. 2 Maccabees stretches over a longer historical period. It gives the background lead up, which is missing in 1 Maccabees. It gives the, by the way, we haven't been mentioning here that 2 Maccabees is the earliest story about the mother and her 7 sons that we know by name, but the name is not there. The name is only in later sources, but that's there. And actually, in 4 Maccabees, if I remember correctly, there's a story about another similar martyr, a man named Elazar. So there were various of these accounts of the similar type event. But at any rate, the point, I think it would be, I would say 2 Maccabees. I suspect I would. But then again, if I wanted people to read my commentary in the collection outside the Bible, I would say that then you should read 1 Maccabees, because I wrote the commentary on 1 Maccabees, even though there's a very good commentary on 2 Maccabees there as well. But really, people should read all of this material. I don't, you know, people should read Josephus.
Right, absolutely.
So, by the way, don't get the cheap. The problem about Josephus is that the Whiston Josephus, the one you get for $15 or something like that, is terrible translation. But the translation of Loeb is too expensive for the average person. I'm not going to buy those things.
No, but I don't know. But Oxford Classics has a new translation from a few years ago by, I think, Martin Hammond Martin Goodman has notes on it. It's about $12. It's fantastic. It has maps. It's notes. It's great. I tell everyone to buy it.
Because I haven't seen.
I'll send you a link after. It's about on Amazon. It's $15 or less with notes. It's a beautiful edition.
George, not Whiston again. It might be Whiston.
No, it's a brand new translation. I don't know why, if they're doing the rest, but they did that. And then it has notes and maps. It's terrific.
But the Loeb is too expensive and everyone doesn't need the Greek.
Right. No, the Oxford Classics is definitely worth it.
Very nice.
I can post a link to this from the show. I'll post a link for everybody to buy on Amazon. It's very accessible. So also I was going to mention regarding books, so Maccabeum Aleph, like I said, should be available in farm stores. The Hebrew one, he's working on Maccabees 2. He says this Charitin. Now I should mention also there's an Ivrit critical edition of Maccabeum Aleph and Beis from Yad Yitzchak Ben Tzvi. Aleph's not available for many years. I don't know why. Only Beis.
Why? What are you talking about? But yeah, I'd be surprised if it's not available. The problem
is Yad Yitzchak Ben Tzvi one. It's only
you have to buy it from them.
No, I don't think Aleph's there. I'll double check.
They don't have it anymore.
I don't know why. I know the same thing. I know
they may have run out. It may have sold out. They're not gonna reprint it because who wants it? A couple hundred scholars.
Right, but there's no, so like you mentioned your English translation, but that's not available just to purchase as a book.
No, you're stuck. You'd have to get the whole thing. Right.
Right. There's no standalone English one really.
No standalone for that. Yeah. We didn't translate it. We used the translations from the New Revised Standard Version. Maccabees, and our feeling when we did that whole work of outside the Bible was there was no reason, and anyhow it would have been unending, to translate works where we could get permission to use a good translation. So any place we were able to do that, we did it. We didn't see a reason. We wanted our scholars to work on commentary, not to work, and people may not know what this is, but outside the Bible's collection of Second Temple literature, Jewish literature, which covers all kinds of things pertaining to the Tanakh. And we still put in Maccabees, we stretched it somewhat, but most of it pertains to Tanakh or works like the Tanakh.
Right, and I want to just jump back to the Hebrew one. So he used the Kahana's translation mainly, and he touched it up, he says, a little bit himself in some places. And he does quote, he uses a lot, there's a Ksaviyat in Paris, Ksaviyat Paris 326, that was written in Ashkenaz at the time of the Baalei Tosfos. That's a Hebrew translation of a lot of it. And he says he quotes a lot of it. It was a manuscript that he says he uses a lot of it, which is interesting. It's just interesting to put out there.
Yeah.
There's another work that we did not get too much, which I think is interesting, is Megillas Antiochus. So people can see it. It's printed, I think, in the Eitra Tfilis, the 2 volumes, I think, has it in there.
It's also in the old Birnbaum Sidurim, which most shuls that own don't use anymore. So people could get, people go to a shul that has old Birnbaum Sidurim, they could ask for the shul to pull one out and give it to them. They have it with English translation also.
So it's either called Megillas Antiochus, Megillas Chashmonaim. What's the story with it? Who's the author?
Well, it really isn't true. I mean, this is the thing. It has all kinds of incorrect information. It has Yehuda dying much too early. It has there's a lot of stuff in there that's just not correct. And it knows the names of the brothers. It has certain information. Most scholars think that the author never saw the actually Maccabees, but he had certain correct information, like the names of the brothers, and he had other things also. The use of the style of the Megillah affects the way he tells the story. So, you know, he's got messengers going out and all this kind of stuff. So generally, it's a nice telling until you want to know exactly what really happened. Now, the question is whether he had any correct sources about anything that no one has. He has Nicanor comes at the beginning, for example. He mixes up Nicanor with some of those generals whose names we know, like Bacchus, that came much earlier in the story. So he has the whole order not correct of the events. And, it's an interesting phenomenon that it never got great acceptance, this work. And there were some Jews in Italy who read it. I don't think they're still reading it, but I'm not sure. I tried to check into that, but I couldn't get a complete story. And to tell you the truth, I thought about it on Shabbos, so I now realize that I should write to a friend was one of the rabbis in Rome, and I could ask him the question, tell me whether they still do it, but they used to read it. But it's an interesting work that echoes some of the correct information, and it's hard to explain how he got it. And we don't know that it was widely read. That's the thing. There are some manuscripts that have it, medieval manuscripts. I'll mention right here that much of this stuff was collected in the Shiltot on Hanukkah. There's all kinds of editions that don't really belong in the Shiltot. That I like the story of also another sense, we didn't mention this at all, is the book of Judith, Yehudit. Now, there are various Jewish versions of Yehudit, which are circulated in the Middle Ages. But in the Apocrypha, the original would have been written in Hebrew, but the original Greek, which is a translation from the original Hebrew, is in the Septuagint, again, is in the Christian Catholic Bible. Protestants got rid of it. In the Reformation, they got rid of these books. But anyhow, in the story of Judith, it's set in the Assyrian period, Ashur, but it's not about Ashur, it's about the time of the Chashmonaim. And she basically does what Yael does in Sefer Shoftim. She lures in the general, Holofernes, who's clearly the general of those who are attacking the Jews during the persecutions of Antiochus in 168 to 164. She lures him by basically having relations with him. Apparently, that seems to be what it says. She's running to the mikvah all the time. And at any rate, no, I'm not joking around, because she wants to be purified from this thing that she did to murder the guy who's trying to kill all the Jews. And this is clearly a story about the period of the Chashmonaim, not about the period of Assyria.
Right. So I did want to jump in. I wanted to mention that I saw this. I haven't seen it yet. I saw it in an email from Gears of Svarim store, and I saw that there's a new edition just put out of Megillas Beis Chashmonoi, Hakru Megillas Antiochus, in Pirish Kavanas Halev. They made it with a Pirish, and they included, it says on the, I'm reading the title page, Koil Medrashi Chanukah Sefer Yosifun VeYehudas. So seemingly right. they put it. I haven't seen the works. I don't know what they did or what happened, but I thought it was interesting.
Every year or so, people want to come out with books to sell for Hanukkah, right? So this new Sfarim on Hanukkah every year. But the reality of the thing is that until you face and work with the real historical sources, like this fellow whose book you're holding now, right? Until you do that, you're really just circling the same basic paths of not having the details. And this gets to a much more fundamental question, which is that, how do you reconstruct the details of Jewish history? And professionals use all the sources available and try to figure out based on them what happened. Whereas some of these people, these sort of internal Frum type works, they have a part of the story. They don't have enough of the story, but they try to do what they can with what they have, but don't turn to the real sources often, which is, of course, you're never going to get the real story that way.
Right, and that's why I mentioned this from one is that I read your introduction. His introduction, he definitely has all the sources. He goes through it. Really, and he has a Scottish also. So it's interesting that he kind of balances that. So I think the most important thing that we've like the elephant in the room or whatever that we haven't danced around. Yeah. There's no Nes Pach Shemen mentioned in Maccabeeim, and as he mentions it, as you know, it's not in any of the Tanaic literature, anything from Eretz Yisrael.
There's a worse problem to this. Let's make it a little bit, you know, explain the full problem. The question is, why is Hanukkah 8 days? There's a whole variety of other explanations for why Hanukkah is given 8 days. Some of them are very stretched. Some of them are not. The most unstretched is the one in the books of the Maccabees, which is that they celebrated the first year a substitute for Sukkot that they had missed because they were in the woods fighting. And therefore, they celebrated 8 days, and that's why they said Hallel. And that is all described most thoroughly in Second Maccabees, and just hinted at in one Maccabees a little and a half a line, but it's very thoroughly explained. And they carried Lulav and Esrog the first year, it says, okay, in the first Hanukkah. That's the first alternative explanation. And then Megillas Tanis has in the scolion, as we call it, this like Gemara-like thing, which explains the reason for the dates, which are just listed in Aramaic, and this section is in Hebrew. There, they go on to give a variety of explanations, some which don't make sense, like that it wasn't 7 lances that they put in to light the menorah, but it was 8, as if they were lighting a Hanukkah menorah, or as they call it in Hebrew, a Chanukiah, right? I remember many years ago when I went for a few seasons to the archaeological excavation at Dor in the 80s. We had a group from NYU there. So one of the Israeli students was, as a joke, he brought a Hanukkah menorah and he dug into the thing and he pulled it. I said, look what I found. So somebody yelled out, what are you talking about? It has 8 candles, not 7. But anyhow, the point is that to make a claim that they had 8 lances to solve that problem. So there are a variety of attempts to solve that problem. And of course, the main one that we know is that the light burned for 8 days with enough oil that should have only burned for 1 day. But that's one of the different accounts that we find in really traditional Jewish literature for why there are 8 days. Now, the other, for example, one of the serious ones is that the Megillat Tanit, they make an analogy between Hanukkah and the Mizbeach being built in the time of Moshe and in the time of Shlomo. And there you see that, for example, Shlomo celebrates his festival, and then he has an 8th day. Now, in his case, he celebrated for 14 days, but that 8th day comes to you 8 days. And then also, depending on how you read it, you can come out that the Miluim took 8 days when the Mishkan was being put up under Moshe. And therefore, that it took the Chashmonaim, remember in the books of the Maccabees, we learn that the Chashmonaim, by the way, we didn't mention the Mishnah in Midot that says that there were holes in the hail that were created because they had to be repaired after the walls at that Tufarso Chomot Migdalam, that the pagans broke down the walls around the temple. But at any rate, what happens in this account is that the Maccabees have to rebuild the Mizbeach because it's been rendered impure by sacrificing pigs there. So they get rid of all the stones, they put the stones in Geniza until the prophet will come and tell us what to do with them, and they build a new one, and it takes them 8 days to build it, according to some of the accounts in the different versions of Megillat Tanit, and different Midrashim allude to this also. So these are all alternate versions for why it's 8 days. And they compete. Now, what's happened in modern times in the Jewish community, for a reason I don't understand, is that, remember, the Rambam tells the story, though, of the 8 days, right? Is that this aspect, which, of course, is the way Hanukkah has been taught to Jewish children for 2,000 years, 2,200 years, right, has become almost a kind of I don't know, a principle of faith. If somebody doubts that this is the reason, they're considered a heretic. How that happened exactly, I'm not sure, but it has definitely happened.
Well, that's what, I mean, the Gemara says, it's because the Gemara and Shabbos says it was the Gemara.
Yes, the Gemara says it, but I think it's more than the Gemara says it. You're right what you're saying, obviously, but there's a lot of other things in the Gemara that it says that if someone said they didn't exactly take that to be the reason, people would not jump up and down the same way. This has become a very sensitive issue in the Jewish community. And it's become a sensitive issue because of some who've claimed that they don't believe that it happened. Frankly, I don't know how anybody could not believe that something, could know something didn't happen if there's no evidence that it happened except one source. You see what I'm saying? In other words, these statements I always find to be silly, that people know something that didn't happen, right? How do you know that? But at any rate, they claim to know that it didn't happen, and then there's tremendous negative response against them. But I think it has become, it's a much more important example than many other of the examples of things that are mentioned by Chazal that are historical.
Right. Well, right. So also the Maccabeum that I was quoting from Charitin, he does discuss this question as well. He mentions Alanisim, it's not mentioned in, et cetera. Right. He has an interesting shot over here. He's quoting from others also that somehow are basically in Eretz Yisrael, it wasn't a nace, the whole menorah, the whole Beis HaMikdash were so many nisim, so it wasn't like a big deal to them. So we find it from the Bavel, it was like a big deal to them, the menorah. So I don't really, people could look it up. Isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I'll have to see, yeah.
He goes through the test. So what's also, what I'm about to mention as well about the, what was I going to mention over here?
Anyway, all these sources mention the lighting of the menorah. I want to point this out.
Yeah, that's
all the sources mentioned that they had to light the menorah when they came into the Mikdash. That's mentioned by everybody.
Right. I wanted to say that also Maccabees 1 also does say that they like you said, they rebuilt the Kalim and they had a Chanukah Habayis on Chafei Kislev. It does say that. They for sure did. And he said they for sure lit the menorah. It says they lit the menorah.
But
for
what
sure.
They don't no say question. Is that the candles lit for burned for 8 days. That's what
it right, say. And they found the Pach Shem, and that it doesn't say, right, so we should, but it does say that they were, there was a nuclear Kisabayis, and it was on
Chafei. Which, as opposed to us, they had to burn all the candles for all the days. Just remember that, because, right, the menorah, the Beis HaMikdash, has 7 candles that have to burn. Not 1 the first day, 2 the second day, 3rd. So the miracle for them, it would be more of a miracle than if it happened in your menorah at home.
Right. Right, right, absolutely. Listen, like you said, there's a famous question on what's the deal with the Pach Shem and Chazal and the differences between Chazal and then it's beyond the scope of discussing
you
here.
Know, this problem exists for many, many events. It's not just this. It exists a lot of things that might be considered to be trivia. And sometimes it exists even between the Bavli and the Rishalmi or between different sources. And what historians do is they try and bring all the sources together and then judge what to accept for what. Now, obviously, the lessons of the Neis Pach HaShem is so great in Jewish thought that to give up this kind of thing, right, is like something would be unthinkable because of so many important lessons that have been learned from it. But the reality is that it competed in our sources with some other explanations for the 8 days.
Right, right. And like I said, I'm sure that he brings some down, but I'm sure there's many other people that touch on this question as well, beyond the scope of the podcast.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
In short, we kind of touched on a lot of this, but what further reading would you suggest on this?
Well, first of all, I'll give an ad for a book by me, From Text to Tradition, which is the history of Second Temple and Rabbinic Judaism, which doesn't just deal with this, but it's a kind of more general work. I still think that Cherikover's book, Hellenistic Civilization of the Jews, where half of it is about this and the other half is about Jews and diaspora, is a great work on the question of Hellenization and the Jews. And for somebody who really wants to read a whole book, I would say that that's what they should read. And I think the one problem is that besides the book that you mentioned, another book that brings together a lot of sources and only in the back claims to deal with what we could call the Frumkeit issue is this book by Aryeh Pinchas Strickhoff, which is called Inside Hanukkah. The problem of this book is in the back, he tries to deal with what you might call the religious problems raised by differences of sources. And even though he assimilates all the sources together in the work, what he says is not really so serious about it. What he basically says is similar to what you said from this other guy about how it's not Osher to read these books. And then he goes on to say that one should always read them, however, from the assumption that Chazal is the main point and you're supplementing. In fact, I've given a lecture often about much of the stuff we're talking about here. What I do is I take the Rambam's account and I take it line by line and then bring all the sources that we have to fill in the Rambam's outline story with all the information that we have. But it's very clear that Jewish knowledge about Hanukkah has increased over the ages. There are some other works that one can read, but I would say that the truth is that there is no work that I know that brings together all the sources in one place. There may be one that I don't know, brings together all the sources in one place and really argues out the issues about how to assimilate them together. And that it's something which needs to be. But in order to get this to be done, the publishers who publish traditional Jewish works would have to decide that these type of work is has an audience. And I'm not sure whether it has a sufficient audience, sadly, because that is really the case. The audience for real history is not yet big enough. It's getting bigger, but it's not there yet.
Now, yes, I want to jump in. Strukov's book is published by Feldheim. And so I want to admit, again, back to this book, The Maccabeum Aleph, I feel that, I mean, I'm not an expert on this in any stretch of imagination, but for me, just reading it, like I said, he pulled together all the sources plus Chazal, and from a Frum perspective, I think, with critical scholarship, you know, he relied on, he said he talked a lot to Yehuda Landy and to Yola Litzer. So he obviously went through, you know, from a Frum perspective, and yeah. Very good. So I heard, this is just hearsay now, okay, this is just rumors. I heard in Israel it's very popular, which makes sense. It's in Hebrew, it's in Ivrit, and there it's much more popular. In America, first of all, it kind of missed the deadline. It was published like 3 years ago before Hanukkah, and you know how it is. So it missed, the publisher, the distributors didn't fly.
Didn't have it before Hanukkah, it's not a new book, yeah.
But it only came to Beagle Eyes, and by the next year it didn't really come. So it was like a whole mess of it. So, and I don't know in general how, because it was in Hebrew, whatever, but you can still get it if anybody wants. I'll try to include a link that I'll find online and put it into the description of the show. I do think for people it's still worth it to buy and to check it out. And I mentioned also the Josephus, the Oxford one, that people probably should general read. So I think we
it's also good to read Josephus around Tisha B'Av. The whole story of the Korban there, that nobody knows what happened to the Korban if you don't read Josephus. I'll just put in another ad that I have a text reader that's used as a textbook in a lot of places, along with From Text to Tradition. It's called Texts and Traditions. And that work does quote a lot of the stuff about Josephus, about the Korban, leading up to the Korban and those events. What I did was I abridged it, though, because it's too much for many people to read the whole of Josephus. So I just put together the accounts there of what actually happened in the Korban. But some of the things you learn about the Korban, things that you would never learn, although, again, you can sit and discuss the same issue as to how it matches up with the discussions in Chazal of the similar issues. And again, what a historian does is to bring all these sources together and try to come up with a picture in which we can explain the events based on all the sources we have.
Right, and two other things. Josephus, the whole Kadmonius Yehudim was just reprinted, the Shalitz edition by Masad Bialik. It wasn't in print. It was just reprinted in two volumes. That's one. Also, recently, a nice little book, people interested, Princeton University Press printed from published from Martin Goodman, Josephus' Jewish War, a biography of it, like a biography of the book, of all the editions.
Yes.
Very nice synopsis. People want to just read a little bit more about the book to find out what the story was. So yeah. I think that's that. So thank you very much for joining me. And I hope
you're welcome.
Useful for people.
Right. And we should wish everybody a good Hanukkah, a Freilich and Hanukkah, and same to you. And thank you very much.
Yes, our friends are coming. Okay, thank you so much.